between, that's human hierarchy in westernized societies. So you look at that and you begin to ask, where are the stressors in socioeconomic status, SES hierarchies? And what's clear is being at the bottom of the hierarchy is bad news. For one thing, separate of our world of psychosocial stressors, you're subject to more physical stressors. If you are poor, you have to haul the groceries upstairs because you live in some old building where the elevator's broken again. You have to walk further with the heavy groceries because the car isn't working. The heat has broken down in the apartment yet again. You have to do manual labor for a living. You've got backaches because you can't afford to get a good bed. A whole life full of physical stressors. But we now move into our realm of psychological, psychosocial stress, and it is way disproportionately focused on the poor as well. Lack of control. You spend your life working on an assembly line instead of being in a position of determining your own occupational fate. And to give a remarkable example of this lack of control, this was a study in the early 90s looking at a bunch of men who had problems with hypertension and thus were taking antihypertensive drugs. And one particular type is a diuretic. It makes you pee more. It makes you pee more and decrease your blood volume, and thus your blood pressure goes down, and that's great. In this study, it was shown that one of the major reasons why working class men with high blood pressure would stop taking their antihypertensives was because they had to go to the bathroom more often than they were allowed to on their job. So lack of control, lack of predictability, very much intertwined with that sort of stressor. Lack of outlets. You don't do the same deal that wealthier people do. You're feeling a little stressed. So time to take up a new hobby and join that expensive health club. And maybe even, let's do something important here, maybe I'll just drop out of the rat race and don't work for 3 or 4 months and spend the whole time making sandals. And you don't have that option. You don't have the same outlets. And perhaps most importantly, you don't have the social support. Now, one of the great myths of poverty is, oh, we were poor, but we were loving, and everyone in our community was poor, so if everyone's poor, no one's poor. And social support, for the most part, this is a myth. The poor have far less social support than wealthier do. For some very simple reasons, you can't do a whole lot of social support when you're working 2 jobs or 3 jobs or spending all your time trying to plug the holes in your life there. Not a lot of social support. So you look at all of this, and you now have to ask a very obvious question, which is, so if poverty is as battering of one in terms of psychological stress, is there a relationship between socioeconomic status and markers of the stress system? You know what's going to be the easiest one to focus on right now. Is there a relationship between socioeconomic status and resting glucocorticoid levels? And the first bit of evidence is coming in for that, looking at, for example, kids. How depressing is this? Kids in the first couple of years of school, and there's already a relationship between resting glucocorticoid levels and socioeconomic status. So this is a very small literature, hasn't been well replicated yet, but first hints that your SES, how you're doing in your society, manifests itself in what your stress response looks like. How about asking the next question, though? What does socioeconomic status have to do with your health, have to do with stress-related diseases and such? And it turns out, boy, is it ever related to socioeconomic status. There is now what is called the SES gradient of health, which is this finding that across all sorts of westernized societies, the poorer you are, the worse your health is. More diseases of all sorts. A whole variety. Cardiovascular disease. The lower your SES, the more likely you are to have problems with that. Respiratory diseases, psychiatric disorders, metabolic diseases, vulnerability to diabetes, inflammatory disorders. All of these become more prevalent the lower you are on the socioeconomic ladder. Okay, maybe these are like little statistical predictors. Maybe these are huge effects. With some of these and some of these societies, there's a 20-fold difference in the incidence of these diseases looking at those on top and those at the bottom. as but one example, you look in the greater Washington, D.C. area, and you look at inner city populations there and the wealthier suburbs, and there's approximately a 16-year difference in life expectancy. These are not little statistical phenomena. These are enormously powerful effects. So you look at those, and of course, what comes to mind immediately is trying to make sense of these. And there's a first couple of hints. For one thing, it's not a universal rule that there is this SES gradient. It pops up in the weirdest places. One of the sort of grand people in the field doing research, and his name will come up soon, has noted that when you look within gender, there was a very strict socioeconomic gradient between who survived the Titanic sinking and who didn't. If you were poor, you didn't get out of there alive. You get SES gradients in all sorts of weird places. You also get a few cases of inverse SES gradients. There's a few diseases that actually become more common among the wealthier. Breast cancer is an example of that. Melanoma, multiple sclerosis, endometriosis, a few other diseases. But nonetheless, there's this big, whopping set of diseases where the poorer you are, the more likely you are to have that disease. And these are meaningful differences. So where's this coming from? What's the cause of this socioeconomic gradient? And a remarkable number of really smart public health scientists have been wrestling with this one for years, and it's fascinating. And it's obviously important. So where's it coming from? Right off the bat, you come with a really easy explanation. The causality horse and cart, chicken and egg issue there of saying, well, obviously, if your health is lousy and you're sick all the time, you are unlikely to be a CEO of a large corporation. Poor health drives down one's socioeconomic status. That makes sense. And you have to go control for that. And it turns out in this SES gradient, this SES health gradient, that it's the other way around, where poverty, poor, low socioeconomic status is the predictor of the poor health. And the way you see this most readily is to look at somebody's SES at some point in life and see how predictive that is of what their health is going to be like at a later point. And one of the most astonishing examples of this is from a research sort of body of studies that are fascinating, having to do with aging, successful aging. And this is looking at a population where the goal was where all of these subjects had had roughly the same food consumption all their lives, roughly the same living conditions, roughly the same number of doctor's visits. Who can you find this in? And in this wonderful body of research, what's researched is elderly nuns. Elderly nuns, they join the convent, the program, around age 18, 20 or so, and for the rest of their lives, they are living under very similar circumstances, wonderfully controlled experiment. And it turns out there's all sorts of features of life experience that predict who's going to have a successful versus unsuccessful old age. One of them is, amazingly, your socioeconomic status at the time you became a nun. The lower your SES, the lower the likelihood that you are going to be hale and hearty in your later years. So we see here a first explanation go down the tubes. Oh, it's just because if you're sick, you wind up being poor because you can't work very effectively. It's the other way around. If you were poor, your socioeconomic status is the driving force on the poor health. So what's another possibility? Once that one's out of the way, it's totally obvious what the explanation is, which is, well, poor people can't afford to go to the doctors. They can't afford to get checkups, preventative stuff. It's issue purely of healthcare access. That makes a ton of sense. You know, if you can't go to the doctor for checkups, you're not going to be as healthy. If every time you're sick, you have to hold on a little longer and see if it will pass because you really can't afford to go into the emergency room, pay those prices because you don't have a physician of your own. This makes perfect sense. Healthcare access. That explains the socioeconomic gradient. Turns out, doesn't in the slightest. How come? For a number of reasons. You see the SES gradient in societies that have universal health care, that have socialized medicine, where everybody has health care that's rather similar. you get the same gradient. It's not quite as steep as in societies like our own that at this point in time do not have universal health care. It's steeper in the United States than in any other country in the world, but the gradient is still there in countries that have universal health care. The gradient is still there for certain diseases where you could go to the doctor for a checkup 18 times a week and get centrifuged on the weekends for good measure, and it's not going to change the likelihood of you getting that disease. Juvenile diabetes, for example. These are diseases that have nothing to do with how often you get to see a doctor, and they still show the same socioeconomic gradient. Another version of it, another version is you look at what people were dying of in 1900, and it's mostly completely different diseases than now, but you saw the same socioeconomic gradient. It's not the disease, it's not the healthcare access, and the Rosetta Stone of the whole field showing this fact is a body of research carrying out by Sir Michael Marmot, who is one of the gods in this field, Michael Marmot of University College London. And what he decided to study was a society of hierarchically organized humans where everybody had sufficient resources and sustenance, that nobody was lacking for calories, but a highly stratified society. He looked at the British civil service system, where apparently there's a gazillion different layers of ranks that you can have, and nobody is starving in there. Everybody has the same universal healthcare access. And what he showed was within the system, every step lower in the civil service hierarchy, the worse your health in all those domains, the worse your life expectancy. Okay, so it's not reverse causality. It's not healthcare access problems. It's obvious what it is, which is poor people drink more than wealthier people. They smoke more. They eat to excess. They get less exercise. All these lifestyle risk factors. And numerous researchers, Marmot leading the way with this, show that you factor all of those in, and it describes like one-third of the variability. So what's the remaining two-thirds about? And up until a few years ago, this is where the epidemiology, public health, SES gradient people would really get uncomfortable, because all these stress physiology people would suddenly jump up and say, it's stress. Why would you think that this is stress? Well, for one thing, you've run out of all of the easier explanations. Maybe it's about stress, this SES gradient, simply by default. The next thing that argued for it is, well, the types of diseases that are most sensitive to stress, those are the ones that show the steepest SES gradients. Another reason why people would argue in favor of stress is that point I just brought up, 1900, completely different diseases than now, yet the same SES gradient was there. It's got nothing to do with whether or not you were drinking pure water because of public health hygiene or any of that stuff having to do with diseases then versus now. The only thing in common was if you were low ranking, low SES, you're enormously stressed. So that's about as far as it would go, which is they'd have to irritatingly deal with some of these stress people saying, whoa, maybe it's mostly about stress. In recent years, though, beautiful, beautiful studies have shown it's about stress big time. First one, some research carried out by Nancy Adler, UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. Now, there's all sorts of research where scientists have big, fancy machines and microscopes the size of this room and gazillion-dollar pieces of equipment and high-tech science. Nancy Adler has done the most remarkably high-tech science of all time. She does her research with one piece of paper at a time. Here's what she does. She has a piece of paper, and on it is a drawing of a ladder with 10 rungs. And the person she is studying, she sits him down, and she says something very simple, which is, you know, when you compare yourself to other people, where would you stand on this ladder? What rung are you on? What is your subjective socioeconomic status? Now, this has to come with some controls. For one thing, it differs by different cultures. Those good old optimistic Americans, the average American, views themselves as above average on this ladder. In Southeast Asian cultures, the average person there, not wanting to brag in this more communal society, rates themselves lower than average. Okay, so you got to factor that stuff in. Another thing you factor in is, well, when you ask somebody, how are you doing? Who are they comparing themselves to? The next door neighbor, to Bill Gates, to some fictional TV character? By saying not, when you compare yourself to your neighbors, when you compare yourself to people you work with, simply saying, you know, when you think of other people, how are you doing compared to them? You're allowing the person to choose what's the relevant community that they keep in mind. And the extraordinary finding that Adler comes up with is, while one's objective socioeconomic status is a predictor of health in a lot of realms, one's subjective status is at least as good. What does that mean? It's not being poor, it's feeling poor. The next body of work that helps pin this down with stress comes from public health sciences Richard Wilkinson. And what he does is look at a critical variable in various societies, how much income inequity is there in a community? Independent of the average income, how much variation is there? And what he shows is the more variation, the more hierarchical income is in a community, the less likely you are to have a peer because everybody is either above or below, social capital breaks down. What he shows is for the same income, the more income inequality, the worse the health of the poor is. And he has shown this at the level of states in the United States, cities, actually even particular blocks in Chicago, all of that. What is he showing there? It's not being poor, it's feeling poor, and what's the surest way to feel poor? Having your nose rubbed in it all the time, surrounded by what you don't have. And what this really brings in here is the power of socioeconomic status to subordinate the health of humans and to do it in a way that's heavily mediated by stress. So we get a confusing point here at the end. Back to the start of this lecture, baboons, marmoset monkeys, what does your socioeconomic baboon rank have to do with how your health is? And what we saw was the answer is, it depends. It depends on what it's like to be a dominant individual in the society. It depends on how stable the hierarchy is. It depends on how many relatives you have around you. Great complexity. What comes out of the human literature on socioeconomic status? You look at utopian Scandinavian societies and you look at sweaty capitalist societies and the gradient is there. You look at societies that are diverse in their ethnicities, ones that are homogeneous, the gradient is there. You control for gender, for age, for race, all of that, the gradient is there. What that's telling you is, something that seems rather odd. Wait, are baboons and marmoset monkeys more subtle and more complex than humans? They come with all of these, well, it depends. It depends on what the particular non-human primate society is about. And here you see instead, in every single sort of place you look among humans, westernized humans, there is that SES gradient. It doesn't tell us that non-human primates are more complicated and more subtle than we are. It tells us something much deeper, much more fundamental, ultimately much sadder, which is when humans went and invented socioeconomic status and invented haves and have-nots, we had come up with a way to subordinate those have-nots like nothing the primate world has ever seen.
Lecture 23, Stress Management, Clues to Success.
Well, if you've still stuck it out with the course up to here, rather than having tossed it in the fire into your sock drawer, angrily demanding a refund, if everything has worked right, we would have gotten you to a certain point right now, thanks to research on the part of the big R&D division of the teaching company. What we would have accomplished by now is you should be feeling depressed as hell. And this is 22 lectures or so into this, and there has been nothing but bad news so far. At this point, it should seem just like miraculous that you're still functioning. I mean, look at all these ways that your body can go wrong. Actually, don't look at it. Let's hold on for one more stress-related disease, and this is as much stress trivia for today as you can get. Remember, okay, see who is actually listening. Remember that disease a number of lectures ago of hair falling out. The version where you don't know why it happened, idiopathic alopecia areata, it turns out there's a stress-related version of alopecia areata, where you are so traumatized by something or other happening that over the next few days, your hair turns white and falls out. This is for real. This is a real disease. This is like a once in a career of a physician's disease, but this is a real one. Look at this. So you're chronically stressed. You get high blood pressure, you get diabetes, you stop growing, you become flatulent, your sex life's ruined, your brain gets damaged, and your hair falls out. How is it any of us are still functioning? How have we not all just collapsed into puddles of stress-related disease? And what's clear is, for the most part, we haven't collapsed into those puddles. We're kind of muddling along, we're scraping along, we're coping. We're coping, and that's the critical point in this last part of the course. What does stress management consist of? What does coping consist of? And what's clear from day one, all the way back to Selye in the 1930s, all the way back to the very first rats that were being experimentally exposed to generalized unpleasantries, what was clear from the very start was variability, individual differences, translated into sort of our vocabulary for these couple of lectures, that from the very start of thinking about stress and coping, it's clear that some individuals deal with stress much better than others. Some cope better. And thus, in beginning to think about how to incorporate some wisdom into one's stress management techniques, inevitably where you need to start is asking, what's up with those individuals who cope better? What does it have to do? Why do some bodies, and even more importantly, some psyches, deal better with stress than others? What are the mechanisms underlying individual differences, enhanced resistance to stress-related disease? And once that's under your belt and you know exactly how that works, how can you sign up and wind up being more like those folks who just happen to be good at that? Because that's where we're going to start. Rather than prescriptions, and rather even than going over the science of experimental manipulations to make individuals better at dealing with stress, let's start off just seeing some of the wild success stories out there of individual organisms in some case, who just happen to be the ones who are spectacular at dealing with stress. Okay, first domain. First domain was promised towards the end of that lecture on aging, which was one of the great ones for nothing but bad news, promising at the very end that, in fact, there's some good news lurking there, good news being what is now called successful aging. And this is one of those scenarios you go to a gerontology conference and somebody gets up and they study this organ system and what their talk is about is how it falls apart during aging, and the next person gets up and they study this other organ and how it falls apart during aging. And it's all really like quite cheerful, but you look closely at the data and you do some math over some of the figures that you're being shown, and what always pops out is there's always a subset of those individual subjects, those individual rats and fruit flies and college graduates and all of that. There's always a subset where things aren't getting worse with aging. And in fact, some of the time these measures are even getting better. And this weird statistical sort of observation is now this whole subfield of successful aging. So what goes into successful aging? Some of the time, as we'll see, it's some pretty logical sorts of things. Some of the time, rather unexpected. First version. What is a version of rat unsuccessful aging? Well, we've heard plenty of this by now. We've heard about how during aging in rats, basal resting levels of glucocorticoids begin to rise, about how the hippocampus doesn't work as well, increasing amounts of damage, their memory problems. And in fact, work that came out in the 1980s, some of it my own, showing that in fact there's a connection between the two. We know one of the pieces of that already, rise in glucocorticoids in the aging rat, causing accelerated aging in the hippocampus for insanely complicated reasons. We're not going anywhere near a more and more damaged hippocampus leads to higher and higher glucocorticoid levels. Yet again, another vicious circle there. And this seemed to be the case until you suddenly realize that's not, in fact, an inevitable feature of aging. There's some rats who don't show this pattern. Which rats are they? We've already heard about them. The rats who way back when had the moms who licked them more and groomed them more, mothering style, playing out in old age. So here we see one pathway towards rat successful aging. And we already see one domain in which this is not going to turn into an obvious prescription for how we go about our mothering styles. Okay, well, what are other cases where you see successful aging? One of the classic ones, seeing what some of the predictors were, is this famed Harvard aging study, which was a bunch of Harvard-associated psychiatrists back in the 1940s took the graduating class of 1941, took a random subset of these men, yes, it was all men back then, and did this grand prospective longitudinal study intensively following these men over the decades since. One of the key issues being, what are the old ages of these men going to be like? And what sort of predictors along the way will there be as to who have the healthiest old ages and the longest years? And out of it come all sorts of interesting findings. Some of them aren't so interesting. What was one of the big predictors? Having a healthy lifestyle. Smoke? And your life expectancy is going to be shorter, even if you're a 1941 Harvard graduate, be overweight, don't get enough exercise, drink too much, all of that. Okay, this makes perfect sense. Next thing that came through in this grand study, have yourself a long-lasting, stable, good marriage, and that's just greatly increased the odds of a hale and hearty old age. Okay, that sure makes sense from everything we heard about social connectiveness and social support, but there may be little things creeping in the back way. For example, having someone who you live with in your later years, you've got somebody who, in addition to all the heartwarming support, you got somebody to remind you to take your medicine. These are the sort of confounds that go into that literature. What other factors? Something else that won't be at all surprising given the previous lectures. Avoid major clinical depression throughout adulthood. And that's a predictor for a longer lifespan and a healthier, more successful old age. And that sure makes sense to us by now. And especially given a finding that's emerged in recent years, major clinical depression, everything else being equal, you've increased the risk of heart disease. A connection there, often years and years between the two events, another price that you pay. So, try to not be depressed. Oh, great. Really useful advice here. Even more so, try not to be neurotic. That's another marker of unsuccessful aging among these Harvard grads. What else? Have a resilient personality, and we will see in more detail what the building blocks of that are, and have an extroverted personality. And that's a good thing, in part because extroversion tends to go hand in hand with decreased risk of depression, decreased risk of neurosis. Okay, so you've got this whole package deal. That's wonderful. That's very informative. This doesn't do me much good. Number one, I was not 20 in 1941. Number two, I was not some good old, good solid fellow Harvard graduate from back when. I'm not even male. I don't have the option to not be depressed or to be unneurotic. You know, there's only so much you can do with findings like these. But there's limits also. What else winds up being a predictor of successful old age? And this one makes a whole ton of sense the older you get. Respect. One of the predictors is if you are in a position in your life, your personal life, your occupational life, whatever, where as you get older, you are subject to, if anything, increasing respect. Wow, is that a predictor of a healthy old age? What are we describing here? We're describing becoming a village elder. And that's a very rare thing in our society because we've got some awfully bizarre, screwed up feelings about the aging process. You're young and all you want to do is be old enough to do this, old enough to learn about that, whatever. And then once you hit this magical stage, and I'm guessing, I don't know, it's somewhere around 30 or so, there's this horribly neurotic transition and suddenly, you want to be mistaken for somebody younger. Suddenly you want to act younger. Suddenly the greatest compliment in the world is for somebody to say, ah, you're 33? My God, I would have guessed you were 31. Oh, why, thank you. Suddenly we have this whole different attitude towards aging. We've got a very weird view of aging. Sit down someone from a traditional African village and say to them at age 50, wow, you look like you're 30 and you've just insulted them. They would much rather look like 70 because that's the time of life where you are most honored, most respected, most powerful. So that's something that's often lacking from our society. And when you see when it does occur, there's some very interesting consequences. Two of the longest living associated professions out there have very distinctive features that go along with these professions. One we've heard about already, orchestral conductors. Part of what's good for them is all that aerobic stuff we heard about. But a big chunk of what's good for them is the control, the respect, the authority, the autonomy. My God, you could be a 90-year-old conductor and you're still determining when all these other adults go to the bathroom, as we heard about. So that's one occupation that predicts a very successful old age. What's the other one, the closest thing our society has to a village elder? Being a Supreme Court justice. Tremendous longevity and function and quality and successful old aging in those folks. And it makes perfect sense. This is like the world's greatest job. You don't work that much of the year. You only pick the cases that are interesting. All the scut work is done for you by these hyperactive manic law clerks. And then you decide things that change the course of history. No wonder these guys do wonderfully. It's our equivalent of a village elder. So these are some of the things that predict successful aging. What are other markers that go along with the folks, the rats, the primates, the humans, who simply deal with stress better than others? Now we move into an extremely interesting, extremely informative, potentially extremely moving literature having to do with people who have children who have serious, severe illnesses. As most studied, parents of children with cancer. And these folks have been studied in lots of settings, but this is one classic study. Took a population of parents, children with cancer, children with serious cancer, and what they looked at were the indices in these parents of stress-related path. What were their glucocorticoid levels like, blood pressure, cholesterol levels, all the sorts of things. And looking, there would be, as per usual, tremendous variability, a whole spread as to some of the parents who were doing horribly in terms of those measures, some who were doing relatively good, independent of how serious the child's cancer was. All of these were cases of serious cancer. So in this classic study, they tried to figure out, well, what are the predictors of the parents who are doing better physiologically in the face of a disaster like this? And this fascinating set of studies where not only are there the medical measurements in these folks, but intensive interviews, psychotherapeutic interviews with these parents, trying to see what's different. There were a few markers that came out, a few key differences. The first one was, what do you do with some of the anxiety, some of the fears intrinsic in this whole cancer process? Here would be a typical scenario. Like virtually any parent in this position, they are there around the clock. This is just consuming them. They're exhausted. At some point, friends or family convince them, you need to go away for a weekend. You need to do something. You're falling apart here. They're finally convinced. Along comes Friday night, they're about to go away for this weekend, and the psychologist working on the project asks them, well, how do you feel about this? And two different categories. There's the first group that says, my God, I know this disease. I know this disease. I've seen children on the ward. It could come in from out of nowhere. It could take them in a few days. My God, what if I'm away and my child dies? Other version, they sit there and say, well, you know, it's probably a good thing I'm getting away, but I'm kind of worried. I'm worried because I'm worried they're not going to pay enough attention to him. Or, you know, the nurses are busy. Maybe one of them will have time to read a book to him. They're not going to read it like I do. I'm afraid it's not going to be as good for him. If you can take, oh my God, what if he dies while I'm away, and turn it into, oh my God, what if the nurses don't read Goodnight Moon as effectively as I do? The ones who could break down these huge worries into these smaller pieces, much better physiological profiles, lower glucocorticoid levels. Next predictor. This was a period when the kids would go into remission, cancer remission, where there was an issue of, are they cured? Is it going to come back? When is it going to come back? So now the psychologists sit down the parents and say, well, how do you feel about this period of remission? And there's the ones who would say, remission? Remission? Don't even say that word. Remission, it isn't. He's cured. She's going to live forever. It's fine now. I don't even want to hear that word. And then there's the ones who would say, well, we're enormously grateful for this period, but you know, the statistics are not great, and, you know, every day is going to be a blessing, but we have to be realistic about it. Parents who sit there and are realistic about it have much higher glucocorticoid levels than ones who say, over with, done, we don't have to think about it anymore. What does that hark back to? Those control, psychological control issues there of, do you always want to have a sense of control, not in the face of horrific stressors? In cases like that, denial might be a very good thing. And here's one of these domains where denial, in fact, was quite protective. Stay tuned, bad news about that nonetheless to come. One additional variable that they found, which was, did these parents have a religious framework for explaining where the cancer had come from? What do I mean by that? On one hand, you have the parents sitting there saying, you know, this is the worst thing conceivable, and this is the biggest challenge of our lives, but, you know, we're religious people, and sometime at the worst moments, I think, God has chosen us for this task. God knows that we can carry this burden. And this is going to sound crazy, but it almost feels good knowing that God knew that we could carry this versus the ones who would sit there and say, God, don't tell me about God in mysterious ways. I don't even want to hear about God this decade or so. If you could look at your child declining with cancer and think that this was a sign that God knew you can carry a burden, much lower glucocorticoid levels. So the starts of some insight here, but again, foreshadowing, these particular studies are going to come back to haunt us big time. What else? Studying baboons, my baboons, in fact, and looking at this world of terrible male-male competition where we've already seen if you're a low-ranking male, you have elevated glucocorticoid levels. Wait, not so fast. It was more complicated than that. If you're a low-ranking male and the hierarchy is stable and the alpha male is psychologically adept, then you have, okay, all those qualifications. But what we also saw was there's another issue lurking in the background there, which is personality. What's your personality like? What's your personality like if you're a baboon? First, do you even have personality? Yes, indeed, and that's one of the hottest topics in primatology these days. The fact that non-human primates, they are smart, they're social, they're long-lived, they have personalities. They have differing temperaments, all of that. What sort of personality does it turn out work well for a baboon, a male baboon, remaining healthy in the face of this wildly competitive world? A number of predictors that begin to make sense. Number one, can you, as this male baboon, tell the difference between the threatening and the neutral things in your life? What do I mean by that? Threatening. You're sitting there, your worst rival on the whole planet shows up, threatens you in your face. This is bad news. So what do you do? What do? You stop whatever you're doing, and you take this very vigilant defensive stance. Contrast. You're sitting there minding your own business, and your worst rival on the planet shows up and takes a nap 100 yards away. What do you do next? What do you do next? You do exactly what you're doing. This is not a big deal. Pathetically, a large percentage of male baboons can't tell the difference between their worst rival threatening them in their face and the guy taking a nap across the field. And you can see their mindset. It's like, look at that guy. Look at that guy. Look at the way he's sleeping and the way he's snoring, and I hate it, and he's doing it just to get on my nerves. This is type A personality. This is toxic hostility, seeing challenges others don't. If you sit there and you can't tell the difference between your rival sleeping and threatening you, about twice the levels of glucocorticoids in the bloodstream. Next variable. The guy is threatening you in your face. What do you do next? Do you abdicate control and allow him to start the inevitable fight, or do you at least seize a little bit of control there? Straight out of our control predictability one. Baboons who sit there and make no attempt to control the inevitable fight, about twice the glucocorticoid levels. Next variable. You've had the fight. You've had the fight, and can you tell the difference between whether the outcome was good or bad? Oh, geez, that's kind of important. And you can tell if a baboon does that by what sort of behaviors they do afterward. A baboon who can't tell the difference between winning and losing, significantly higher glucocorticoid levels. Finally, you've had the fight, and you've lost. What do you do next? Do you go and mope by yourself? Or do you go and do something social, mope by yourself, higher glucocorticoid levels? Look at this profile. Can you tell the difference between the big things and the little things? If it is a big thing, do you at least get some control over it? Can you tell if the outcome's good or bad? And if the outcome's bad, do you have some effective coping mechanisms? People pay to be taught stuff like this, and some baboons just happen to be more that way than others. Okay, so all of this is very exciting, very wonderful, very heartwarming, full of optimism. But what if you happen not to be the right sort of baboon, or not happen to have the right temperament in the face of the nightmare of cancer, or you didn't happen to have a mother who licked you the right amount back when? What can you do to, in fact, still make use of principles like this? What can you do to change? And what becomes clear is that, nonetheless, change can occur. One of the things that we find to be particularly unlikely, which is stuff can change. Athletic conditioning, people go from being out of shape into in shape. What does being athletically conditioned consist of? You lower your baseline of glucocorticoid levels and heart rate. You increase the ceiling of it. You recover faster. That happens. Certain types of individuals with type A personality who've just shown up with their first heart attack with some very intensive work, they could change their profiles. We change. We grow, we mature, we harden, we grow together, we grow apart, we get bored, we change. It's possible for us to change. And not only is it possible, but it's hard in terms of there's no free lunch in the next lecture and a half. But nonetheless, change can occur. And where you get some of the most insights into it have been experimental studies where people have manipulated some of those psychological variables and brought about change. First version of this, extraordinary studies. You take one of the worst medical things that happens to people, which is something goes wrong, disaster, and they have a chronic pain syndrome, constantly in pain. And these are people who live for when they can get their next medication, their next painkillers. All they do is sit there in the hospital bed hitting the call button. Is it time yet? Is it time yet? It's misery for everyone involved. Some years ago, some researchers tried out something that seemed loony, where you have these powerful painkillers, and they said, no, instead of these patients driving the nurses crazy all day long, what if you gave them the medication, put it on the side of their bed on the nightstand, and whenever they needed some, they would take it? What if you allowed them to self-medicate their painkillers? Oh my God, the AMA had apoplexy. You can't do that. They'll become addicts. They're going to overdose all of that. People tried it, and you know what? Not only don't they overdose, when chronic pain patients can self-medicate, they take less painkillers. And what does that tell you? When you were lying in bed there and it hurts and you're not sure if anybody's paying attention on the call button when they're going to come and you need more pain medication, then it tells you two things. You're medicating the pain, but you're also medicating the lack of control. Another domain. Nursing homes, the aging process is in lots of ways the experience of loss of control, loss of outlets, loss of autonomy, and winding up in a nursing home is one of the front lines of how that can go wrong. Wonderful studies done, led by a psychologist named Judith Rodin at Yale at the time, going into a nursing home and manipulating some of the psychological variables there. Things like you give one of these individuals a plant, and in one case, as part of the experiment, you say, oh, you need to remember to water it every day, and in the other, well, I'm going to come in and water it for you. Give the person some responsibility, some autonomy, something as trivial as that, and people's level of energy, people's level of activation get higher. Much more subtle version, and this an extremely important classic study. Now you go into a nursing home. Three different conditions. The first one, the control one, there's no differences in how people are living. Second one, you come in and you say, oh, we're doing this study here, and I'm wondering if this social worker student can come in every Thursday for 2 hours to talk to you about your life. Third version, oh, we're doing this study here, and I'm wondering if this social worker student can come talk to you a couple of hours a week about your life. When would be convenient? When would be convenient? Like you have a busy schedule there under these circumstances, but you know what the outcome's going to be. Socialization in interactions with a social worker, and you do better than the ones who are the controls. But have that minimal bit of input in there in terms of when would it be convenient for you, and you do significantly better. Remarkable finding. Remarkable finding that's just about to backfire on us big time. Now, if you read all of this superficially, you come out with the same potentially bad conclusion as at the end of that lecture on psychological factors with stress, which is, what's the solution? You know, slap a smiley face sticker on your forehead and just get as much control, as much predictability as possible. And it doesn't work that way. And we saw the formal versions of it in that previous lecture. You don't want to get your information too far in advance. To what does that look like in the real world? First example, the kids with cancer. What did we see? The parents who could deny the possibility of cancer coming back were doing significantly better, lower glucocorticoid levels. It happened in one of these studies that the children came out of remission. The cancer came back. The cancer came back fatally. And what happens in the aftermath? You take the parents who all along were saying, you know, this is wonderful, this is a blessing, but, you know, it may very well come back, and their indices of health, stress-related disease, got a little bit worse. You take the parents who were sitting there all along saying, it's over with, it's not coming back, never have to think about it again, back comes the cancer, and they wind up more stressed. So the denial worked only until the point that reality overwhelmed it, and then you did much worse. Another example of this, and an extremely powerful one as well, back to those nursing home studies. So what did they just do? This wonderful experiment. Okay, the social worker's coming, you know, when's convenient for you versus coming Thursday for 2 hours, all of that. And the folks who see the social workers are doing better, the social contact, throw in the element of control as well, does even better. It's great, study's over with, 14 doctoral theses handed out, it's terrific. And you know what happens at this point, which is these participants, researchers, these social workers come in and they say, well, you know, the study's over with, so we won't be doing this anymore. Oh, I'm going to come back and visit all the time. But it's not going to be as regular anymore. And you know what happens, which is you never see him again. So what happens at that point? You have these individuals in the nursing home who, thanks to this social contact, are now doing better mood, doing better level of activity, voluntary activity, doing better, fewer doctor's visits. Everything is great. End of the study, and student social workers don't come anymore, and do these individuals drop back down to where they started? No. What they did was they dropped back down to lower than where they started. Think about this. This makes perfect, horrible sense. You're sitting there in a nursing home. You're alone. You're isolated. Your kids come to visit you resentfully once a month or so, and this is pretty bad. But just imagine if you're sitting in this nursing home and you're alone, you're isolated, your kids show up now and then, and up until this past week, that young person, that energetic person would come by every week and seemed so interested in you, and oh, you looked forward to it, and now they're not even coming anymore. And there's very few of us who have the strength and resilience not to have been knocked down a whole bunch of steps there. What do we see here? Hope can be an amazingly powerful, sustaining set of feelings, but nothing destroys us more like when there's hope that turns out to be utterly unjustified. This begins to give us a first warning as we transition into this final lecture, how to apply some of these principles to yourself. What we see here is it's not simple. What we see is there's no free lunch. What we see is there's double-edged swords all over the place. You want to get it right, because if you apply some of these notions simplistically, not only don't you help buffer from the effects of stress, you perhaps even make things worse.
Lecture 24, Stress Management. Approaches and Cautions.
Well, we are here for the last lecture, and this is one built on the previous one, stress management, and now beginning to apply some of these things. So it's probably worth having a recap of the previous lecture. Let's see, it was, oh my God, I feel so depressed. whoa, there's some people who deal really well with stress. It's not going to be me because I didn't have the wisdom to pick the right womb to develop in. Oh, but there's experimental manipulations that could make people deal with stress better. Oh, but if you do it wrong, it backfires on you majorly. So with that recap under our belts here, the challenge now is to begin to take some of those pictures of spontaneous success of dealing with stress, some of those demonstrations of experimental manipulation that make individuals better at stress and keeping the cautionary notes in mind, and beginning to see now, how do you begin to apply these principles to yourself? So this is going to be a grand overview of some different components of stress management, and of course, coming with all sorts of qualifiers, which seems to be the habitual thing that I throw in here, but let's see what we can find out. Starting off, first thing you can do, exercise. Now, I put that at the top of the list because I manage to exercise every now and then and feel enormously self-righteous about it. So I figure by putting it at the top of the list, it makes it seem like that's the most important one and is going to help me the most. Exercise is a good thing. Exercise really is a good thing. It helps in all sorts of ways. Here's one obvious one, which is it decreases your chance of cardiovascular disease and plaques and occlusions and all of that. And among other things, that seems to protect against certain aspects of brain aging and cognitive decline. That's a great thing. That certainly makes sense. If your cerebrovasculature is not getting gummed up, you're going to have a brain that works a lot better, that functions better, that ages better. But an interesting additional example of the unexpected advantages of things like exercise stimulates the formation of new neurons in the brain, that adult neurogenesis stuff. Exercise causes your brain to make more of types of chemicals called growth factors, nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, things that make your neurons grow new processes, new connections, all sorts of good stuff like that. Exercise is obviously good for you within a range of benefits that can be obvious, could be unexpected. One qualifier that comes in already from so many lectures ago about the effects of stress on the reproductive system. You can overdo it. Nonetheless, get it within the optimal range of homeostatic balance, and exercise is a great thing. But it comes with certain requirements, certain qualifiers, and these basically apply to everything we're going to hear about in this lecture. First off, you can't save your stress management, you can't save your exercise for the weekend. It's got to be something that's virtually daily. Next, you can't do it while you're, you know, holding the phone for 30 seconds and decide this is a great opportunity to do some like one-arm push-ups or things like that. You need to stop. You need to take the time out for it. It needs to be something which, by definition, if you were doing it, you were communicating, this is important enough that I'm going to say no to all those things that can't be said no to. In the particular realm, for example, of aerobic exercise, what most of the studies suggest is you need to do 20, 30 minutes worth of it to begin to get the cardiovascular advantages. So you need to do this sort of stress management thing on a fairly regular basis. It can't just be in a spare second to grab an opportunity for it. Certain types work better than others, aerobic. And interestingly, unintuitively, until you hear it and then it makes perfect intuitive sense, there's one more requirement with exercise as a means of stress management with virtually any of these. You gotta like doing it. Oh, there's a voluntary element to it. Voluntary, and this could be shown with like an incredibly elegant study. Okay, in this study, you take something that rats love to do. You have a rat in a cage and you give it a running wheel. Rats love running on running wheels. Rats, during their nocturnal awake phase, will run the equivalent of miles on a running wheel. They are scampering around in the world. So you've got a rat in there running on its running wheel, getting its aerobic working up for its marathon, all of that. In other words, it's running voluntarily. Now, going back to a design we've heard about a lot, you have a yoked design. In the next cage, there's a second rat with a running wheel. And the deal is, every time the first rat runs and moves the running wheel, this one moves exactly the same. And the difference is, the second rat is stuck inside the running wheel. In other words, it's doing the exact same amount of exercise, but it's not doing it voluntarily. And what you see is, in the first case, you get all the beneficial health effects of exercise. And in the second case, when you've got this rat stuck in there and it's, you know, health club trainer is forcing it to do this, you don't get anywhere near as much of those benefits. And that's real informative, not just things like exercise. And as we'll see applying this to lots of these stress management approaches, it's got to be something that you don't dread and aren't made miserable by. I mean, as one example, meditation. Meditation, as we will see shortly, meditation does all sorts of great things for you. If it happens to work for you, we'll go over the evidence. It happens that this is not the sort of thing that works for me. If I were to do like 20 minutes a day of transcendental meditation, I would have a stroke by this weekend. It is so antithetical to what I'm about. Nonetheless, it works for some people. The voluntary element has to come in. Now, that voluntary element, the business about what is it you are using those muscles for, what is it that you are exerting that energy for, it depends on the context, it depends on the meaning, all of that comes in a very interesting way, coming back to that exercise business. So, you could be running for your life because the predator's coming after you. Or you could be running for your life because, no, you could not be running for your life. You could be running joyously amid the right background music to embrace your beloved at the middle of that field with a blowing blaze of grass. In both cases, you're using your thigh muscles. You could be dealing with some sort of horrible, taxing setting where you're working really hard, muscular exertion to save your life, or in the right settings, you could be doing the same very happily using those muscles during sex. And a big question in the field is, wait a second, on a certain pure energetic metabolic level, running for your life or running with a pastel-y background music to your beloved, you're consuming the exact same energy. You're increasing your heart rate in both cases. You're increasing glucocorticoid levels in both cases. Remember that truism way back earlier, the opposite of love is not hate physiologically. Leap up for joy and leap up in grief, and your heart's going to have to do very similar things. How does your body differentiate between the two? Very important sort of finding. You remember the amygdala from just a few lectures ago, the amygdala, fear, anxiety, conditioned fear. In general, if you were running across the field with the background music and it's great, you're increasing blood pressure, heart rate, you're secreting glucocorticoids, all that sort of stuff, but your amygdala is not activated. Go running for your life, and it's the exact same energy demands, the same nuts and bolts reptilian part of your brain powering it, but in addition, the amygdala is going to activate. And that turns out to be a sort of a key way of differentiating studies with sex where, in terms of running for your life, amygdala activates, sex, it doesn't, amid using the exact same muscles. You're probably wondering at this point, so how do they study that one with those brain imagers and all of that? And the answer is fruit flies. Actually, that's probably not the answer, but nonetheless, that represents a great methodological challenge. How do you differentiate between the two? But remember, this brings us back to that truism, the opposite of love is not hate. Your body's working really hard running with joy as with running with terror. Okay, so a sense here about the role of exercise. Moving on, meditation. What is clear is when it works, when it's done regularly, when it doesn't drive you out of your mind, when it's all that sort of thing, it's actually very beneficial. It lowers heart rate, it lowers blood pressure, there's evidence that it lowers cholesterol levels, in particular the levels of bad cholesterol. What is unclear in that literature, which is quite controversial, is just how persistent are those effects. And it's not entirely clear, at least in my read of the literature, but at the very least you can get transient benefits. So that seems pretty rock solid. There's one huge confound in that literature, though, which is the problem of self-selection. And that's going to run through a whole lot of these techniques. It's not just anybody who proves willing to meditate on a regular basis. People who would voluntarily do so, they're probably already somewhat different from other folks. What's the gold standard of those sorts of studies? You assign people either to the meditation or no meditation group. That's the well-done sort of study. You get your lab rats. These rats are going to do TM. These rats are not. You come back and see how the blood pressure is. That's the way to do those studies, to get around that self-selection confound there. What are other possibilities? Well, we know ad nauseum now from a bunch of these lectures going way back to the building blocks of psychological stress. Get yourself more of a sense of control. Increase control in life and that's going to be a great thing. You're going to feel more in control of your life. We saw that low control, low autonomy in the job setting is a real predictor for bad outcomes. More control, more control. Not always. And you'll notice this pattern by now. Here's a great intervention, not so fast. Control, as we know by now, is not always a good thing. Control in terms of everyday life, dealing with stress, is not always a good thing. And I heard a wonderful example of this from a friend of mine, a physician, and this was during his medical training. This was during medical school. And this was the start of his first surgical rotation. And the first day, and he goes into the operating room, and there's some, like, amazingly complex surgery happening. And there's dozens of people all around.